Corral v. United States. Mr. Schindler?
Your Honor, before I proceed, I'd like to revise my allocation of time. If I can have 8 minutes and there's 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Ralph Schindler. I was appointed to represent the petitioner in this case, Mr. Herrera Corral. This is a habeas proceeding. This case is related to the case of U.S. v. Robles Ortega. Robles Ortega is the father-in-law of the petitioner. As the court may recall, Robles Ortega and the petitioner were arrested and indicted in the same case back in 2001. Robles Ortega was represented by Ralph Metchak in the trial court, and petitioner was represented by Larry Hyman. A suppression hearing was held and suppression denied before Judge Gottschall. Robles Ortega entered into a similar plea agreement to this petitioner, basically preserving the issue of the suppression evidence. Robles Ortega filed his notice of appeal, came up here, and was reversed. Unfortunately for the petitioner, no notice of appeal was ever filed by Mr. Hyman on his case, and some 3 or 4 months later, after he was in Rochester, Minnesota, I believe, he got a fellow inmate to file the petition that was presented to this court, basically, and the petition for habeas proceeded to a hearing, and after about a 4-day hearing, the court determined that petitioner was not denied effective assistance of counsel because, one, there was no actual conflict of interest, and in any event, petitioner was not prejudiced, and two, that his counsel satisfied the requirement of discussing appeal rights prior to sentence in a 1 or 2 minute conversation, and that defendant discharged Mr. Hyman, and thus Mr. Hyman was not deficient in his performance. It is submitted that the trial court opinion that was an error, that in fact, as to the conflict, the evidence of the hearing is set forth in the brief, and I don't want to reiterate that, except I would just point out to the court that generally we are the client of the party who pays our bill or pays our fee, and it was clear in this case that Hyman's fee was in fact being paid by Metchak's client, the father-in-law, Robles Ortega. And this fee arrangement was never disclosed to the court. And it is submitted that this fee arrangement put Mr. Hyman in an untenable position, a conflict of interest, in that he had to get his client to proffer in order to obtain the safety valve. And the only way to get the safety valve is to have his client tell all that he knows about Robles Ortega, the man who's paying Hyman's fee. And it is submitted further that, in fact, there was prejudice in this case and that the court denied this petitioner the safety valve. He was a first-time offender. Otherwise, he qualified for safety valve. The only thing that was missing was to make a full and truthful disclosure of what he knows about the case. As to the notice of appeal, the trial court found that it was governed by Roe versus Flores Ortega, and that there was a discussion of appeal rights, and that the defendant expressed his desire to waive his appeal and then fired Mr. Hyman. It is submitted that that finding is clear error, and that the ABA standard regarding appeals first requires the discussion of appeal rights to take place with a sentenced defendant, and it's clear that he must be a sentenced defendant. Here, the only evidence of a discussion comes from the testimony of Mr. Hyman that he had a, quote, 1 or 2 minute discussion with the defendant about his appeal in the lockup at the site of court after sentencing. Now, I should be about 2 minutes into my presentation, so that's how long this discussion was about your appeal rights, and appeal rights that are preserved in a plea agreement, appeal rights that are very complicated on the suppression issues, and that's the extent of the conversation. Whether this conversation even occurred is debatable. Even Judge Gottschall found that it's hard to believe. In fact, her quote was that the marshals never allow such conversations after a sentencing hearing to occur in the lockup at the site of the courtroom. And contrary to Mr. Hyman's testimony that the defendant waived his appeal rights, we have certain uncontroverted facts. First, the defendant testified that it was always his intent to file his notice of appeal. That was contained in his testimony at trial and his affidavit. He stated that at the day of sentencing, when this conversation supposedly occurred, he had a migraine headache and didn't want to talk about anything. Further, in the testimony at trial, the defendant's wife and sister both testified that immediately after sentencing, Mr. Hyman proceeded to pack up his bag and walk out to the hallway and met with the family. While the defendant went to the lockup at the site of courtroom, Hyman never went into the lockup to have this discussion. They stated that in their discussion with Mr. Hyman in the hallway, that they discussed appeal rights, the filing of the notice of appeal. They stated that Hyman wanted a fee of $10,000, which they told him they couldn't afford. Hyman basically admitted having a conversation out in the hallway, stating that there were good issues for appeal, but he said that he felt he was discharged. The third part, or the third piece of evidence showing an intent to file a notice of appeal, is on the change of plea hearing. This was admitted into evidence, and at that hearing, the defendant asked the judge if his plea allowed him to appeal. He specifically asked that at the change of plea hearing, and the judge advised him, yes, it does. Further, we have a written plea agreement. This is the only document we have that's in writing that expresses what the defendant wanted. I mean, here he is. He's got a written plea agreement that has his signature on it. It says, I preserve this issue for appeal. Now, Mr. Hyman couldn't come up with an appellate waiver. I specifically asked him at testimony, do you have an appellate waiver? No, I don't have one. There's no memo in his file anywhere. There's nothing in writing that indicates a waiver other than the testimony of Mr. Hyman. Further, the testimony at the hearing was from the wife that she received numerous calls from the petitioner about the filing of the notice of appeal, that she tried to call Mr. Hyman for the notice. She went to the clerk's office. She continued to call Mr. Hyman's office, but he would not return her calls. Hyman's credibility is discredited by the fact that he signed an affidavit stating that he had never blocked calls from this defendant. But subsequent to that affidavit, I subpoenaed the records of the MCC, and in fact, the defendant had blocked calls from this defendant. I would cite the court to page A29 of the short appendix, and in there are the records of the MCC, and they show specifically that the calls were made by this petitioner to 312-346-6766, which is Hyman's office, and the result is a code 31, which at A21 means the call was blocked by the called party. Thus, beginning on June 12, 2002, for about a 5 or 6 month period before he was transferred out to Rochester, during this whole period of time, Hyman had placed a block on calls from this petitioner. How can you have effective assistance of counsel when, in fact, your counsel has blocked all calls from you? The trial court found that there was a discussion of defendant's appeal rights and the defendant discharged Hyman, and then Hyman's services were not deficient. It is submitted that as a matter of law, a discharged attorney cannot just walk away. Hyman's actions would be equivalent to the captain of the Titanic. After he hits the iceberg, he calls New York, says, the ship is sinking. You're fired. Well, and then the captain gets on the first lifeboat and abandons ship. Under the ABA standards, you're not allowed to withdraw or abandon ship in this case and give up the ghost, basically. His duty was to file a notice of appeal, knowing that the individual wanted this appeal. You can't just walk away. You have to file a notice of appeal or make a motion to withdraw or whatever. In summary, this is a story of two defendants with two different attorneys. The co-defendant, an experienced drug dealer with prior criminal history, hires Ralph Metchek, enters into a plea agreement, appeals the suppression issue, and is free following his appeal. This defendant, a Mexican immigrant who speaks no English, the new son-in-law of Robles Ortega, is given the legal services of Mr. Hyman, and although he qualifies for safety valve, he doesn't get the safety valve. Although he has a written plea agreement that preserves the suppression issue for appeal, no appeal is filed. His attorney even places a block on all of his calls from jail, making it impossible to consult his attorney. This defendant is sentenced to 10 years and continues today to serve his sentence. Mr. Metchik's client is free. It is submitted that once Robles Ortega's case was appealed, Hyman effectively abandoned this client. He blocked his calls. He failed to consult regarding appeal rights, failed to protect his interest upon termination of services, and that such performance denied this petitioner the effective assistance of counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Schindler. Ms. Gerling.
May it please the Court, Michael Gerland on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, the district court decision rejecting defendant's story isn't surprising given the pile of lies and the inconsistencies that the judge uncovered and that were uncovered over the course of last summer in this case. The fact of the matter is that, and the record shows, and the attorney testified to this, and the interpreter testified to this, the defendant was advised of his appeal rights. He was advised of his appeal rights by the judge. He was advised of his appeal rights by his attorney, Lawrence Hyman. He was advised of his appeal rights by Frederico Rodriguez, the interpreter who was an associate for Mr. Hyman. And the record shows, and the district court found, that after being urged by Mr. Hyman and Mr. Rodriguez to go ahead and file an appeal, which the attorney had preserved him in the plea agreement, the defendant chose not to do so. That was his choice. The attorney can't go and file a notice of appeal when he's been directed not to do so. The defendant did come to regret that decision, and several months later, in February of 2003, he filed his first, or the original 2255 motion. In that motion, he claimed that he didn't appeal because his attorney told him there were no viable issues to appeal. Well, that statement, as the record shows, turned out not to be true. It didn't work very well for him, and so a year later, he revised his 2255 motion. This time, he claimed that he did not appeal because he wanted to. He tried to call his attorney after sentencing, but he couldn't because of the block on the MCC phones. And I'll get to the issue of the block. There was a block on the social phone of the MCC, but the fact of the matter is a defendant never tried to call Mr. Hyman after sentencing. Indeed, he was caught in that lie as well on cross-examination at the hearings before Judge Gottschall on the 2255 motion. And it's unsurprising, given all of his lies, that Judge Gottschall found that the defendant's story wasn't true. And the problem really with the entire appeal here is it's all founded and it's all premised on a false story. And what the district court did find is that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel because all Larry Hyman did, after working hard to preserve this issue for Mr. Robles Ortega, for Mr. Herrera Corral, was to follow his client's direction, as he's required to do under the Supreme Court precedent. With respect to the block on the call, there was evidence that on October 17th, a block occurred. It's not clear who, if a secretary picked up the phone, if someone pressed the wrong button. When you get a call from the MCC, you get instructions, press this button if you want to accept this call, press this button if you don't want to accept calls from the MCC. The testimony before the court was that Larry Hyman's secretaries and his answering services instructed to accept all calls from prisoners 24 hours a day, whether or not they're direct or collect calls. There are other ways the defendant could have contacted Mr. Hyman if he wanted to. He could have gone to a counselor. He testified he didn't go to any of the counselors because they're all black. But there are separate phones upon which there was no block that you can use at the MCC to call your attorneys. And the defendant knew it because he received a manual that's in Spanish and English that advised him about those phones. He could have picked up the black phone at the MCC that dials into the federal defender's office. He didn't do that. In fact, he had a federal defender. So the fact that there was a block on the call with regard to one of the several phones available to him really is besides the point. And indeed, he never told Larry Hyman about that. So I would submit that the district court's decision was really the only decision available on based upon the record before the district court.
You say
court.
He had a federal defender. How did that fit in with that?
At some point in the proceedings, defendant filed his own downward departure motion, after which Judge Gottschall assigned a federal defender to meet separately with the defendant, and the defendant met with the federal defender. He testified at the hearings last August that when he met with the federal defender told him that he wasn't safety valve eligible, that he couldn't do anything for him that Mr. Hyman wasn't doing, and based on that, the defendant made a decision to stick with Larry Hyman and not with the federal defender. So he was...
I'm sorry, Mr. Garland.
I was finished.
Mr. Garland, Mr. Hyman has his conversation at the MCC with regard to appeal with the short conversation with...
There was more than one conversation. It was on the day of sentencing, and Mr. Hyman testified that he spoke to his client before the sentencing at length about it. There was conversation, and if you read the record, there's some off-the-record conversation with the attorney during the sentencing. And then he said that he did have a brief conversation. So this brief conversation after sentencing, is it the tail end of...
Well, is it that brief conversation where the defendant says he doesn't care to go on?
I believe it's during that brief conversation that he just reiterates that he doesn't want to go on. And
Mr. Hyman's testimony is that his prior two conversations, both before the plea on the issue of appeal, he indicates he doesn't want to appeal?
But before the sentence, that he had gone in and said, we've reserved this right for you.
Yeah.
He said, I was as surprised as anyone when he told us to forget about it, that he doesn't care about it. So they repeated it. And then he had his assistant, Frederico Rodriguez, who spoke Spanish, discuss it with him. And Mr. Rodriguez couldn't remember. And this occurred 4 years ago, so they weren't entirely sure when it occurred. Mr. Rodriguez testified that we would have had a lengthy conversation with him before on the day of sentencing, that we would have followed up after. And what he said was, I remember this. He just sat there. He seemed upset. He says, no, that's okay, in response to filing the appeal. We reminded him, look, you still have a chance to do this. Even after you're sentenced, even when you're doing your sentence, you can appeal this. You should appeal this. This was reserved for you, this right. This was a very good thing that was done for you. Normally, you don't get this kind of thing in a plea agreement. Normally, those issues are waived, but this was reserved for you. You should do it. And again, just sort of dropped his head and said no.
For a second, is that an accurate representation in a motion to suppress situation that's not normally reserved in a plea situation? I don't know whether this associate is a lawyer or not,
he was referring to the fact that there was a conditional plea agreement, because normally when you plead guilty, you give up most of your trouble.
We're focused here, and allegedly these conversations deal with this preserved right, reserved right to appeal. Would that be an accurate representation? And if you're pleading and your one issue that you might have something on is a motion to suppress, and you say that's not normally something you would have?
Well, I think normally you would be giving up your issues that you might have otherwise had if you went to trial, which would include some extensive pressure.
You have an appeal waiver, right?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. So based on that, Your Honor, and everything I said.
Mr. Hyman, Mr. Gerland, say he's unable to represent him. What does that conversation occur where he could not? You have the appeal right, but I'm not going to be the one who can carry forward.
That was a conversation that Mr. Hyman testified he had with the defendant's wife after the defendant had said, "No,
that's
I don't want to appeal."
He advises her it will cost $10,000.
The wife testified that Mr. Hyman then came to her and said. That Mr. Hyman went to her and said, I'll actually represent you, but it'll cost $10,000, which, of course, is inconsistent with what the defendant said.
As I understand it, there appears to be, at least in the government's position, is that there were like three points of contact with the defendant by Mr. Hyman and or his associate on the issue of the capacity to appeal this point.
Correct, as well as by the court.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's occurred during the plea. Now, at what point, though, does he know he's without the possibility of having Mr. Hyman be his lawyer? Does that all occur after? In other words, during all these conversations, Mr. Hyman has not yet said, I'm not going to be the one who would take your case. Is that right?
And it's I don't know that Mr. Hyman ever said that to the defendant. It's not clear from the record that he ever said that to the defendant, just that he was telling the defendant about his appeal rights, that he can file a notice of appeal. The defendant said he didn't want to. He told him again he should do it. He said he didn't want to. He then went out and spoke to the wife, and what Mr. Hyman testified to, which is different from what the wife testified to, the wife testified that Larry Hyman said, I'll represent him for $10,000, and her story was, we didn't have $10,000, that's why we had to get a federal defender, and he was going to help us get a federal defender. But what Larry Hyman testified to is, I then went out and spoke to the wife after the defendant said he didn't want him to file a notice of appeal, and he said, essentially, he doesn't want me to file a notice of appeal, but you should. You should get a lawyer. You should do it. I think at that point he realizes that he's not going to be the one to do it. He did also testify that he didn't want to do it anyway because he had a bad relationship with this defendant.
Did the wife testify at the hearing?
She did.
And she confirms that's the dialogue that occurred?
No, what she testifies to is a little different than what the defendant testifies. She testified that Larry Hyman told
her. I want to compare the two people in the conversation are the wife and Mr. Hyman. So I guess I just want to know what
the wife testified to was that, I can tell you. Mr. Hyman testified that he talked to the wife, that he told her she should hire someone and file it, that they have 10 days to do that, and it should be done as quickly as possible. He told her to file a notice of appeal as her father had done, and that if she couldn't find someone to do it, that the federal defender was available to do it for them. The wife testified differently. According to her, Mr. Hyman offered to do the appeal for $10,000, which she didn't have, after which he then directed her to get a public defender, but did urge her to go ahead and file the appeal.
So he told her to get the federal defender and take the appeal.
Correct.
And that's both the wife and Mr. Hyman say that's
said. That's consistent.
Correct.
She just added the $10,000.
Correct. Based on
Mr. Hyman offer to file a notice at that point without a issue of a plea, just file a notice of appeal?
He didn't, but he had been instructed at that point not to do anything. I don't think I don't think the wife could then direct him go ahead and file a notice of appeal when the client has said don't do it twice.
Now, in all those conversations, he's either accompanied by an interpreter or his associate who speaks Spanish? I guess I just want to make sure on the quality of the exchange between Mr. Hyman and...
On the day of sentencing and on other occasions, his associate was there, so his associate was present in the lockup at the side of court when they had the conversations, before, during, and after. There was another court interpreter, and Mr. Hyman testified he couldn't remember if at one point he had a conversation with the client and just with the interpreter.
Well, does Judge Gottschalk find that during these critical conversations, at least on the issue of I don't want to appeal, that there's no language problem?
The conversations occurred in Spanish.
Mr. Hyman, is he fluent in Spanish?
No, Federico Rodriguez is, in fact, he was a court interpreter in Cook County. Before he became a law assistant. And the judge did find, when she made the credibility findings, not just that it was Mr. Hyman's story versus the defendant's story, but that it was Mr. Hyman's story and Mr. Rodriguez's story versus the defendant's story.
And I guess, just so I get it straight, Ms. Rodriguez is in attendance when? As to these three?
He testified that he remembered one lengthy conversation, which was from the one that I quoted. What he testified to was that they would have definitely had a very full conversation with him at the outset before sentencing, and then would have spoken to him.
This last critical one where he says, I don't care.
He said they would have spoken to him again after, but he couldn't recall how many times they spoke to him.
So. Right. So he can't remember the two post conversations. He can't remember the conversation Hyman had with the defendant after the sentencing.
Correct.
Right. And then he was not present, or was he with the wife? Did she have the same language issue?
It's not clear from the record whether or not he was present. I would assume that he was, just because he had been with him on the day of sentencing, but I don't.
What about did Judge Gottschalk's comment about marshal's not permitting conversations in a lockup afterwards?
If you go down the district court today and or tomorrow and you watch the hearings as they occur, defense attorneys always go back into the lockup and have conversations with their defendants. Sometimes we sit and we wait while they have conversations. Sometimes we have a break so they can have conversations. After a case is done, the marshals frequently won't allow the defendant to sit out and talk to family members or friends, but they frequently will let the attorney just go back in the courtroom, lock up for a minute. It depends if there are other cases, in which case they certainly will do it because they're sitting in court. It depends what their schedule is, but it happens.
I just want to be clear, too, now on these conversations, whether it's two or three, because there's the critical conversation before the plea, right?
Correct.
And then there's the conversation the day of the sentencing with the defendant.
These conversations all occurred on the day of sentencing. And Larry,
so right before the sentencing, the lengthy conversation about the appeal rights.
Correct. And Larry Hyman testified he spoke to him before, and the record shows that they spoke during, and he testified he spoke to him after.
So there are three conversations, and all three of them he's urging him to file the notice?
Certainly in the first one and the last one, and they're discussing his...
So there were two where he was telling him that he should appeal.
Correct.
So Mr. Hyman goes forward with the plea and reserves the right for him, even though he knows the defendant isn't interested in the preservation of the right?
No, that...
I thought there's a conversation before the plea, Mr. Berlin, where he is not interested in appealing.
This is before the sentencing.
Excuse me, before the sentencing. I'm sorry.
And I'm a little confused. The plea agreement was negotiated and done months before these conversations ever occurred, and that's why Frederico Rodriguez and Larry Hyman all testified that they were so surprised by the defendant, and that's why when he said no, they reiterated, you know, that this was a right that had been preserved for him.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Schindler?
Yeah, just a few comments. First of all, there was no conversation at the MCC. I think you asked one about when did these conversations at the MCC. They never occurred at the MCC. They occurred in the lockup at the side of the courtroom. So there was never, right. And I think the evidence was pretty clear that there was some extensive conversations prior to the sentencing being imposed as to, you know, what your appeal rights were. We don't contest that. I think there was this conversation. But the problem is, I think at that point in time, the guy probably thought he was still going to get the safety valve. He was still eligible for a safety valve, he thought. And lo and behold, he gets, you know, 10-year mandatory minimum. The issue of the federal defender, basically what happened was he did file his pro se motion for downward departure, but he also made a motion to fire counsel to remove Mr. Hyman. And at that point in time, Judge Gottschall called the federal defender in, and there was some conversations, and I think basically the answer was that the evidence is overwhelming, you're better off doing a plea agreement or whatever, and that they proceeded in that regard.
He wants Mr. Hyman removed because he's considering going to trial at that point?
No, I think he wanted Mr. Hyman removed because at this point in time, Robles Ortega was already done. He was on appeal, and he was getting no service out of Larry Hyman. He wasn't, if you recall from my brief, there were all these dates for sentencing that kept getting moved and delayed and everything else. There was no, you know, pre-sentence report, no response to any of that stuff being done. I mean, at that point in time, I think he was saying, I'm not getting anything here, you know, and that just goes back to my argument that the real client here was Robles Ortega, okay, and once Robles Ortega is taken care of, we're done, okay, and I think that's basically what happened here. I guess one argument I would like the court to consider, which I added in my brief, was what happens if, in fact, you change your mind during that 10-day period if, in fact, as Judge Gottschall determined, I mean, but she says in her opinion that she could find no cases, I could find no cases, that if, in fact, you change your mind on day 9, what do you do at that point in time? Aren't you the attorney during the whole 10-day notice of appeal period? I mean, if Hyman was correct in what he was saying, on day 1 I'm no longer there, what happens to your rights during that 9-day period? I mean, it's pretty clear from this record that...
Did you suggest Mr. Hyman make repeated inquiries each day through 10?
No, I'm suggesting the fact that he couldn't get hold of him because his calls were blocked.
But what about what the government says, that the federal defender phone was not blocked, and he had actually contacted, I mean, he knew about the federal defender because of that motion to withdraw, and at the MCC that phone was available.
I don't think he knew about that phone. I mean, his motion to withdraw was done by another prisoner there at the MCC. This guy speaks no English at all. He speaks only Spanish.
What do we do with these credibility findings of Judge Gatcho, though, on the quality of Mr. Hyman and...
Well, you have to. I know what the standard is, Your Honor, and I know it's a difficult standard. But in this case, basically, you've got the testimony of Mr. Hyman, but his testimony is going against a plea agreement that's in writing. Okay? I urge you to consider something like a statute of frauds, because this case, I mean, these facts come up all the time. I mean, if you have a written plea agreement that preserves the issue for appeal, you better get an appellate waiver signed by that defendant, or else you file a notice of appeal. That, I think, should be what's done. I mean, that's certainly what I would do if I was in Mr. Hyman's shoes. I wouldn't just... And also, the standard says it must be with a rational defendant. I mean, suppose this guy's got a migraine headache, as he testified, he's irrational on that day. Maybe tomorrow he's going to be rational. I mean, the standard says it must be a rational defendant. Okay, that's the ABA standard, and Strickland incorporates the ABA standards into the rule. So, I mean, sometimes, the defendant is his own worst enemy. So, and our duty is to protect them from themselves sometimes. So, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schindler. Thanks to all counsel. Schindler, you have the additional thanks to the court for accepting this case and ably representing Mr. Correll.
Thank you.
Case is taken under